Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We are up here on Capitol Hill in Senator Dan McKay's office, and he represents the political right.
Hey, everybody.
And on the political left, we are so happy to welcome to the program Representative Brian King.
Thank you. It's been a while, but I'm glad to be back.
Brian, nice to have you. I would love, just from your perspective on the minority side of the House, to just kind of characterize what's going on here the last week. What does it feel like? Give our listeners a sense of what it's like to be up on Capitol Hill right now.
Well, it's kind of like starting up a car at zero and running it as fast as you can over 45 days at the highest speed possible, at ever-increasing rates, and on day 45 crashing it into a brick wall. That's how it feels.
Is it too fast for you, Brian?
Why did you invite Dan to be on this thing, Natalie?
So
it's winding
Brian
up.
Brian wants a longer session. He wants a full-time legislature.
I don't
no,
want
but
either
it has
of those
this
things.
Intensity.
Oh, it has.
It is built by design to crescendo.
Yeah, it is. And
right?
It's exhausting.
And we are at the inflection point of the crescendo.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very good way of saying it. We're at the initial crash of the cymbal. I have likened the end of the session as like, you know, you go from this feverish, hectic pace and everything's frenetic and crazy. And then you get into the session or the session, you know, midnight comes, you wake up the next day. And I feel like I'm in a vat of molasses.
Can't
I mean,
move.
I'm moving. Yeah. Well, the other thing that you hear in your mind, Natalie, and then the next two nights after the end of the session is the chimes in the House.
Boom,
didn't
boom,
you hear the
boom,
chimes
boom,
in your
boom,
mind?
Boom, boom.
Oh, yeah.
Boom, boom, boom,
yes.
boom.
After my
boom,
first
boom,
session, I made a mistake, and I changed the chimes to my ringtone.
Oh that was a mistake.
And it took me a week to realize that was a real mistake.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like sales tax reform, the tax cut are looming large. This is HB 441.
They haven't even thought about it in the Senate, Natalie.
Representative Tim Quinn from Heber City is carrying this bill, at least from the House. Let's just break it down a little bit. And Dan, I'm going to go to you as the majority party. You're saying it's still caught up over in the House, but you certainly know a lot about this.
Sure.
Former chair of Rev and Tax.
Based on the emails, the texts that we're receiving, Utah's economy is going to crash to a halt.
And you're believing that?
Well, I'm just saying,
the
emails.
Okay.
I'm thinking
that's not a great indication of when the cycle ends, but.
Well, you know, passing tax reform, apparently. My favorite comment in this whole deal comes out of Brian's crazy caucus. The press asked Carol Spackman Boss, and she gave, honestly, it is the if I was going to give an award for trash talk of the session, it goes to Carol Spackman Moss, who is not a likely recipient of the award because
she's a very thoughtful,
Former
school teacher at
my alma
mater. So the press
asked her what she thought of the tax reform deal, and she said, "Well, we really don't have a position on the tax bill in Democratic caucus, but all I know is if they pass it, we're going to need a bigger caucus room."
Oh, that's pretty good.
Oh.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I was not amused at that.
You weren't?
Nope.
I thought it was hilarious.
Well, it wasn't hilarious to me because it
you
got to
go make
the,
deals, right?
No, I don't got to make deals. I got to make good policy. And we are up here committed as Democrats to making good policy for the future of the state of Utah. I've said to people, look, I'm a lawyer. I get a ton of emails and calls. Ask my intern.
Our lawyer buddies are gone.
Our lawyer
gone
buddies
crazy
have gone crazy. And I say to them, listen.
And you two are both attorneys, by the way, for our listeners.
Our lawyer buddies
and
who have
this
advanced.
This bill contemplates a sales tax on legal services.
That's right.
So they have advanced degrees and they're asking us how to do math for sales tax.
Well, they say this will have an impact on the legal services and the cost of legal services. And you know what? It may very well do that. I estimate that for my law practice, which I have my own law firm, about 10 employees, it'll probably cost $5,000, $10,000, maybe $15,000 a year to comply with a sales tax on my legal services. But I'm not letting that factor in to my vote on this. Why? Because with my legislator hat on, I have to figure out what's the best for the state of Utah in the future.
Representative, let's stick with that because you're making a pitch for good policy.
Yeah, and we got to have good policy up here. And I was quite honestly, that's the only comment, Dan, that I've heard from any member of our caucus that even alluded to the politics of this. And I have said to Carol, Representative Moss, I cringed when you said that because this shouldn't be about politics. It's not a political issue. First and foremost, it's a policy issue, and
okay,
I want to make
so
it a
policy issue. And Dan, I don't know exactly where you sit on the bill at this point, and it's been a moving target.
Yeah.
But but the policy is very sound. I'm just going to be the broader political base, medical say that.
Broader base,
so
lower
what
rates.
You want in tax policy is you want it to be fair. You get fairness through a broad base.
Yeah.
To the extent that legal services hasn't been in it, you've been getting a benefit.
That's right. You can argue that.
The other thing you want.
Brian likes broader base, higher rates.
Well,
so
the other thing you want is efficient. And efficient means low rates because you don't want to get in the way of market decisions. The higher the rate, the more you impact the market decisions. That's inefficient. So broad base, low rate. And then you want it to be revenue sufficient. You want it to bring in the revenue you need. So
the other part of that, though, Natalie, and this is the concern about 441. The other side of that leaf is you also have to make sure the collection is predictable, because the worst thing you can do is create a policy that collection becomes its own onerous burden.
Sure.
Right. And so
that's
nice
part of
the
administrative
tax,
burden if you can't forecast the revenue.
Yeah. And so that's the big.
I want to relieve your pressures there.
Oh, okay.
Well, only to say that we can get this figured out, meaning as the people that quantify and calculate these numbers. You know,
listen to the
we'll
economist, Dan.
Hey, but let's go back to where's this headed?
I'm just a lawyer. We cannot do math.
Where does it sit right now? And I'll go to the House for this.
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Natalie, because I think what you're seeing is an effort to put a few smart people who are acting in good faith to come up with good policy in a room and come up with something, namely Representative Quinn, who I have great respect for, and he and I are very good friends. Senator Fillmore over on the Senate side has been working on this, and some people from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget in a room to come up with something. And they're not the only ones, of course, but it's been
but
a relatively small group.
Okay.
And they've been trying to come up with something that works that they can present to initially the House and have the House vote on it. The problem is you got a supermajority in the House. And the supermajorities, when it doesn't matter whether they're R's or D's, when you have a supermajority, the supermajority thinks that they just need to talk to themselves. Mm-hmm. And we, as Democrats in superminority status, have not been privy to these conversations in a meaningful way. When the bill was unveiled, Representative Quinn came to me and the Speaker came to me and said, look, we want to tell you about it. And they did, and I appreciated that. But the fact is, Democrats have not been at the table. And neither have people representing the service industry been at the table.
So we've got 1 week left, and you can't really tell me where it's headed.
I don't think that the Republicans in the House know where it's headed.
Let's go over to the majority side, but to the Senate. Dan, prediction on this one?
The gas pedal is to the floor on the issue.
Okay, so that means that leadership is doing everything
there.
They know how.
And so I think there will be a bill. My bet is the implementation may be delayed so that we can collect and make sure that we're collecting the right revenue.
So, Dan, you think something's going to pass?
I think something's going to pass.
I don't think anything's going to pass.
And I'm going to be in the political middle, no surprise, that there is a bill passed, but that it's phased in a way that's much like a delayed implementation. But I don't think you go this first year without something.
We are going to fund a larger caucus room for Brian.
Before we go to break, I want to bring up the income tax. We've been talking about the sales tax, broadening the base, lowering the rate. But they've also talked about in this package reducing the income tax as part of the tax cut. It makes this all more complicated. Quick comments on that.
I know
where you have Dan Brown.
He likes higher rates.
No, I don't like higher rates. But what I do like, people need to understand every dollar that's raised from the state income tax under the state constitution goes to the education fund. It goes to fund public on higher education, period, end of story. When you want to talk about reducing income tax, what you're saying is we're going to take an earmarked amount of money out of a fund that's specially dedicated for public and higher education and put it in a general fund that we can use for anything. And if you've run for office like most Democrats have, having as your one of your top two or three issues being more funding, more resources for public and higher education, you don't do that lightly. We've done that before. We did it in 1996 when we changed the Constitution. We cut income taxes again in 2008 when we made a single rate. We've regretted it because it's cost us a lot of money.
Dan, it seems to me like this is where the compromise can come together because to the degree that Republicans need more votes, all they have to do is be a little easier on the education tax cut and they'll get up from the Democrats. Are you concerned about the income tax cut? Are you concerned about it affecting education appropriations?
Here is, this is where the rubber meets the road on the policy. I understand the optics, and I think Brian discusses the optics. The rubber meets the road is you take a dollar out of education the way it is today, you're toast. And I will say Doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat, there's not one single person in Utah who wants less money in education. I don't care who they are. Well, okay, never mind. My neighbor down the street probably doesn't want more money in education, but anyways, he's a sovereign to himself.
He was talking about a real neighbor there.
Oh, yeah. Trust okay. me.
It wasn't hypothetical. It
yeah,
was
he's de-annexed from the country, but that's a whole other issue. but I will say that, so I think there's that. The revenue that comes in, I think when you look at the last I heard, it was like $70 million or $75 million that we were talking about as a cut. You have to be able to communicate to the state of Utah that in a surplus year, while we're doing all of these changes to taxes, one, education will be at the very least held harmless, and two, that taxpayers will see some of their money back. And I think you see both of those. And if you can accomplish both of those, I think you have a path forward on the bill.
We're going to close out this segment, but I just want to say from the political middle, I believe that the most important thing for education is a strong fiscal makeup of the state. And that ought to be in people's minds. So I think the reform can actually help education. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle with Brian King, Dan McKay, and Natalie Gochner. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
It's Brian King on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner, in the political center, you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We are on Capitol Hill. Want to talk about the session? We spent the first segment talking about tax reform.
Taxes.
Also, in the last week, another big thing happened. And you guys are the attorneys, but the Supreme Court of the United States decided not to hear the appeal, correct?
That's right.
For the Count My Vote lawsuit. So this is the law that allows people to get on the ballot through signatures, not just through their caucus and convention.
Right.
Dan, you carried the initial bill, so we always start with you on this.
Yeah.
I was real happy to see that the Supreme Court would not hear this. It basically says our law is constitutional. Count my vote.
Well, careful with the overgeneralization. I think Brian, as an attorney, would agree with me. Okay. Just because the court doesn't take something doesn't mean like it's constitutional. Like there could be.
But it was unanimous. Not a single one took
absolutely.
It up.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. The Tenth Circuit ruling is left in place.
That's right.
All right. So from my standpoint, using signatures to get on the ballot is popular. It's working. Voter participation's up. We have more choice.
Not because of that. But
you're going to say because of marijuana, but it is up. We have more choice.
No, because of mail-in balloting.
That too.
We started mail-in balloting far before, and trust
me, we have more choice, more competition. So this is, I think, very positive for our state.
It's lovely, isn't it? We can all come together now. Dreams are coming true.
Sarcasm doesn't come through on this in the same way as we saw your facial expression.
It should.
Dan, what does it mean for the next election cycle, the next two election cycles?
Nothing. I mean, at the end of the day,
doesn't it mean that the legislature is now going to, I mean, that the Republican Party is going to look for a legislative change and try to change the law legislatively?
Oh, I think there will be. I think there will be some.
Let me put it this way. You were rumored and gave reason for this rumor to be true that you were thinking hard about running a bill at the beginning of the session to basically rescind SB 54.
Yeah.
Now that the SCOTUS has ruled, we're too late in the session for you to really do that. I think you'd agree, wouldn't you? Would you, if you'd known, if SCOTUS had ruled 3 weeks ago, would your decision about not running a bill be different?
No. I think no. But here's what, okay. I'm going to take off all of the emperor's clothes for just a moment.
Please,
so
please.
Cover your eyes.
Are
please.
You the emperor? Because I don't want you taking your clothes
off. No. I'm just wearing them for the moment.
Okay.
So, you know, I borrow extensively from his wardrobe. So my biggest beef is we can't let the issue go. And the Count My Vote folks are like, well, maybe we'll run another initiative again. Or maybe we'll do this. And it's like, freak.
Well,
can
the anti-SB 54 people won't let it go either. I mean, they say
they won't, but I think as time comes and goes, I think this will become more normalized. I think.
You think that the alternative path to the ballot is more likely preserved than not because of the ruling?
Time definitely tends to go that way.
Okay, we have other bills up here to modify the initiative process. So this is the process to take the law into your own hands as people and pass legislation
right.
through the populace. House Bill 145 focuses on ensuring a voter knows what the initiative is before signing a petition, and they have their ability to take their name off. The bill requires signatures to be submitted every 14 days, and the list of those who have signed places online. Anything on that one?
No, I mean, you know, it doesn't make it harder, I don't think. Do you think this makes it harder at all? I mean, how you look at it?
I think whenever you're forcing people to show who has signed something earlier, it gives the opposition more chance to go get those names taken off. So I think it makes it harder to get a ballot.
Well, I can tell you this. There's a lot of sensitivity on the part of Democrats, Natalie, about anything that actually or is even perceived as seeking to undermine the initiative process in light of Prop 2 and in light of Prop 3, how they've been treated. We're going to see a bill in all likelihood that deals with Prop 4 before the end of the session. Now, whether that'll be contested or consensus is yet to be seen. But people are sensitive about it, and I think that Democrats
and
are particularly
well placed. House Bill 133, this is the bill that delays the effective date of initiative to the same date as bills after the session, if it involves a tax change.
Oh, yeah.
This one's probably coming from the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah,
deal.
I haven't seen it yet, so
hasn't come this way.
Yeah, it isn't on our side of the fence yet.
Is that a HB or an SB, Natalie?
It's HB 133.
Okay.
Yeah. One more. House Bill 195 makes some changes to the initiative process, including modifying the number of signatures from 10% of those who vote in the last presidential election to 8% of active voters.
And if you are an initiative gatherer or initiative person, I think this number is easier to trace than the number is trying to figure out how many were in a presidential election in a particular year or whatever it might be. So in a lot of ways, they've dropped the percentage down, increased of where it's at. And if I remember right, it was like within 1,000 of how many people different it would be.
Yeah.
And I think the sponsors tried really hard not to create another burden, but also tried to make the process more predictable.
Yeah. Let's go to some issues that might be a little bit more contentious here on Capitol Hill. Anything going on with air quality that our listeners would be interested in?
We've got a ton of good air quality legislation, but it's all pretty expensive.
And so it's one thing to like the idea, but another thing to fund it?
Yeah, it helped, I think, that the governor said as part of his budget proposal and his State of the State address that he wanted to spend up to $100 million for clean air initiatives. I think you are going to spend, you're going to see tens of millions of dollars spent for clean air initiatives, whether it's taking sort of a cash for clunkers idea, taking old cars off the road that are particularly dirty, or whether it's Tier 3 initiative incentives and things like that. But I think that you're going to see some progress in that area, simply because, if for no other reason, people in the state of Utah have spoken very clearly
about
this. Yeah.
What about, there's two, there's the hate crimes bill, and then there is the conversion therapy bill. Dan, where are they sitting at this point?
So the conversion therapy bill, really quickly, for those of you that don't know, House Bill 399, its primary intent was to do away with this, treatment where people try and un-gay people is the best I can, somebody described it to me.
Simplified way, yeah.
Yeah. It was a battle of therapists and over what was allowed and what wasn't. And what ended up happening is the bill was substituted in committee in such a way that the sponsor no longer liked his own bill. And so he circled it when it got to the top of the, when it came time for it to be debated. So it's dead, and the advocates have said, hey, instead of go forward with that language and try and find a compromise at the end, what they would rather do is spend the summer, like we do with a lot of issues up here that are hard to pass, spend time in the summer and try and come up with an interim bill that, is more consensus-based and, I think will probably yield a better bill.
Okay.
We had that heard in committee yesterday, Natalie. Very interesting discussion. And it was the continuation. Actually, maybe it wasn't yesterday. Maybe it was Monday. But it was the continuation at all. I don't know.
Just if you could see Brian's face there,
it's all blending.
Blur.
But it was over a two-day period. We had a hearing last week on the same thing. A lot of great information. But it's contentious. I don't know that they're going to be able to bridge the gap. But what ended up passing was something that, from Equality Utah's perspective and from the perspective of a lot of people who want to ban conversion therapy in a very broad way, disappointing and diluted down to the point that it was a nothing burger. And that's why the bill sponsor pulled it, basically.
So
I agree with Dan.
I'm done.
It's probably going to be something that we need to look at over the interim. Whether they'll be able to bridge the gap, I don't know.
And then hate crimes.
Yeah.
We mentioned hate crimes. For the first time, it got a vote in the Senate, and it passed out of the Senate. I think the final vote was 17.
Do you support 19, it, 11, Dan?
I did not support it.
You said last week that you would not. And you,
yeah.
I remember your reasoning that had something to do with, well, what did it have to do with?
So if you, for our listeners, if you want to go and Google the Justice, the JRI.
The Justice Revitalization Initiative.
Thank you. So the JRI was basically... What happens with crimes is something happens in the community and it's horrible and the sentence doesn't match the crime.
It dealt with recidivism.
Yeah.
Yes,
and, legislators come up and they say, well, we need to stiffen the penalty on this, right? And what it does is it sends your criminal penalties a little skiwampus about what's penalized more here and there. So,
And if your goal is to
if you refocus
change
and
behavior.
Make it on, or rehabilitation, which is what the JRI was about, was how do we focus on rehabilitation? So if you change your penal system into one of rehab, the one thing we know is that incarceration actually increases the amount
worse.
Of recidivism.
Yeah.
And so here we are with hate crimes, and I'm just going to say this because I didn't say it on the floor and I kind of regretted it. But think about the people that are committing hate crimes also. We're generally talking about poor on poor crime. It is the worst, right? And when I think about, you know, you don't generally see wealthy people out committing hate crime, one person or another, and so
they sometimes commit other types of hate crimes.
Oh, sure, yeah, sure.
Just,
and yeah, there are other atrocities,
sort of throwing
right?
Something
and
out there,
they're probably more astute at how they hide their activity too. Anyway, that being said, they're not breaking in and leaving threats about, you know, like curry in a hurry. Anyway,
Brian, were you supportive of the hate bill?
Well, it's a tough issue because you've got to be very careful that you don't infringe on free speech kinds of things, freedom of religion, freedom of expression. So I think that people are trying to thread the needle here. Mm-hmm. Senator Thatcher's been working on this for years. He's had a lot of people who have been helping him work on it. I think he's tried to thread the needle. And what we've ended up with is this long list of stuff that is on there, all the way from matriculation to ethnicity and religion. I think that if you don't like hate crimes, as Senator McKay's talking about, you're not going to find anything that really you like. The ACLU of Utah, I'm a board member of that organization. They're very ambivalent about the case, and so they want to, I don't know what they're going to do. I think they're neutral at this point. I'm probably going to vote for it.
Okay.
I think that
it's a
positive
thing. It's interesting. We've only got 3 minutes left on the program, but I do want to talk about the Inland Port Hub and Spoke bill. This is interesting. If I've got this right, this is the idea that we could have a satellite version of the Inland Port where you could have regional centers throughout the state that can clear customs and do some things.
Right.
And this bill, it's HB 433, would essentially expand the Inland Port boundaries if the governmental body of the new area voted for it.
And it would be interesting. You know, the key areas I see something like this happening is look out of the east part of the state.
Yeah, Vernal.
Right, Vernal.
Vernal
Price. Throw something out to the basin. But it also might be interesting if you look at Tooele or look at Tooele County from that standpoint and all of the ground that we have available out there. It would be interesting. Be a very interesting concept.
It's interesting, too, that Representative Gibson, when he first unveiled the bill, a week or two ago, had a lot of opposition initially, but he's worked hard with people who have brought legitimate concerns to him. And I think that to some extent there's a little bit of a consensus developing around it at this point. I think it came out of committee with only a vote or two negative, and Salt Lake City Council, for example, is supporting it. They spoke in favor of it. I don't know where the mayor is. But
from the political middle, I love the thought of the Inland Port benefiting rural Utah.
Yeah. Oh, I do too.
You know,
I think that
it's critically
we need
more
important.
Economic opportunity there. Hey, let's go to gripes. Dan, we're going to go to you first.
I knew she's going to go to me. No, it's okay. So, I'm not going to do my usual thing where I'm tired or grouchy because honestly, I slept in today. I didn't have committee this morning, so it was a delightful morning. My big thing is that there is not enough time. And when you're a legislator and you have good policy, like we talked about the tax policy, it is hard to educate the public on how the policy actually works. And that is my big gripe, is there is a lot of misunderstanding about
details,
the tax policy.
Complexities.
And it's so complex. And of course, we are killing business. We're killing, and it's just so hard. That's my beef, is that it's hard to get the water to the end of the road so that people understand why we're doing what we're doing.
Quick gripe.
Quick
Brian.
Gripe that ties into what Dan has said, and that is we don't have enough time up here to do some really important things as thoroughly as I'd like. This the tax bill is a good example. I mean, we're having it sprung on us at the very end. It's not the fault of anybody in particular other than we've only got 45 days to do our work, and I think maybe unrealistic expectations were in place about our ability to get something through as quickly as something complex.
We've been the whole program. We haven't mentioned Donald Trump. My gripe's going to go to President Trump. He hosts Division II college football champions, but ignores women's champions in the White House sport ceremonies.
Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised, but we need the president to honor women championship teams. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've been joined by Dan McKay and Brian King. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Cooper's here with us. Thanks for listening.